of our podcast this week, we're joined by the double whammy of Forest Whitaker. Yes, we saw him for the trees from Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, and David Brent himself, Ricky Gervais, also drops by the pod booth. Plus usual movie news, reviews, and interviews on the movie podcast that likes to take a ridiculous meander, or a ridiculous Lin-Manuel Miranda from time to time. Yes?
Close enough.
Yes?
Close enough.
Hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, appearing for the last time this year before she takes a break. As I understand it, she's heading to the Theatre Royal Winchester, where Cinderella is in panto, in the hopes that Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles appear and take their shirts off.
I see what you did there. It's terrible, and I wish you hadn't.
I should have finished the sentence. And that's where I went wrong.
I am going to see a panto tonight.
Okay, this I didn't expect. What?
I
know you go to lots of theatre.
Yeah.
I did not expect that you went to panto.
I know an extremely talented musician and comedian called Vicky Stone, and she's appearing in panto in Aladdin, in Hammersmith.
She was the one who was on this morning, wasn't she, doing a song a few years ago?
That would be right. Yeah. She's done a great song about Brian Cox.
You know her?
And I know her.
You personally know this person?
Yes. We ran the marathon together. We didn't. She ran a lot faster than I did.
But this is someone you hang out with?
Yes.
So this is a famous friend?
I mean, yes. We're not like buddy buddies. I don't want to claim her as like a token, like I'm putting her on my mantelpiece, but you know.
But you say she's your best friend?
Yeah, I would say like we're basically inseparable.
Is she going to be your maid of honor at your wedding?
I mean, certainly.
Unless
she agrees to marry me, you know, in which case, fine.
Now that's a wrinkle I hadn't expected. I will introduce you in a second, John. Sorry.
No.
John's here.
Please,
John's here.
Take your time.
John Nugent. Because honestly, for John's intro I wrote, and last but not least, is the quiet man of the pod, our very own George Harrison. And I stopped because we were in a rush to get into this booth.
Yes.
Is there anything?
You know that there's some existential queries about whether John exists.
Yeah, I understand this.
That's become a thing now.
I understand this. Is this your new thing?
I guess. I don't know. It's for... Yeah. I can lose the rage reputation, I think I'm okay with.
I think that's behind you.
That's behind me. I've gone to the anger management classes. It's all, it's water under the bridge.
Like George Harrison himself, who emerged from under the shadow of Lennon and McCartney to forge his own path, first as a Beatle, and then as a solo artist, and then, of course, as a travelling Wilbur. What?
It's
totally true. You have put that in the past where it belongs. In the rage closet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just like Dr. Bruce Banner.
Yes.
So anyway, so you do exist. I can verify this.
I believe I do, yes.
Can we be sure he isn't a solid light hologram? I don't know.
It's possible I was created in a lab by Anthony Hopkins. It's unclear.
See, I've always thought that about you and about Anthony Hopkins.
You thought Anthony Hopkins...
had a lab and probably created journalists in it.
It's the
logical... I mean, just look at him. Come on, he looks like that kind of guy, doesn't he?
I think that's absolutely fair. He does. He seems... He's got restless creativity, hasn't he?
Exactly.
As old Tony.
Exactly.
And, presumably he's also forming his own food supply, right? Hannibal Lecter.
Oh no, that's wrong.
You just grow your own.
I've been watching a different Hannibal of late. So
yeah, yeah.
It's okay. Like a human allotment.
The human allotment, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And in this human allotment, there's lots of little animals. Over there, there's a human butterfly. Over there, there's a human centipede.
Oh, Chris. Ew.
It's the sort of animal you get in a human allotment. Don't blame me. It's
Can
John.
We not have a callback to that infamous episode?
Right, should we have a question?
Let's do that, yes.
Welcome to the podcast, both. Oh, dear. I think what's happened is, this is the penultimate podcast of the year.
The regular one, anyway.
The regular one. Yeah. We have two more big old specials coming up very, very soon. They'll be fine, but I think we're just a little bit stir crazy.
It's December.
Yeah. I've
had a bit too much mulled wine.
And I've had one too many pieces of fudge. Not a euphemism for anything.
Not a euphemism.
And I've been locked in a room all week working on a feature, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the feature is?
No.
Is it the cover feature?
Yes.
Is it the next cover feature?
Yes.
I know what it is.
Yeah. but we can't definitely can't say that on the podcast now that you've given that away.
We can't, but I do know what it is.
Yeah, I know what it is.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, I know what it is.
It's like we work here or something.
High five, you guys.
High five, yeah. It's good. What are we doing? Oh yeah, podcast.
That's right, films.
So, but I'm just intrigued by. I'm intrigued in many ways by Helen. But Helen is about to leave, and where are you going for Christmas?
I'm going home to Northern Ireland.
You're going home to Northern Ireland. Have you done all your Christmas shopping?
Mostly.
These are the questions I was saving for next week, but now Helen's leaving.
Yeah, I have to pick up some stuff that I've had delivered to various places.
And when you go home at Christmas, do you switch off as a film journalist, or do you watch films?
Oh, I watch films. How do you switch off except by watching films? That doesn't make any sense.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. John, what are you doing for Christmas?
I'm going to Wales. My grandfather lives on a farm in Wales.
Holy cow, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, Christmassy.
So we're going to warm by the fire. It's basically like the end of It's a Wonderful Life, my family.
Mm.
It's just, you know, just lots of people singing carols and being like, oh, Merry Christmas, you old buildings alone. It's exactly like that.
Exactly like that.
Yeah, my dad is Jimmy Stewart.
Okay, let's have a question now. And the question is Christmas related. It's from Katie Trainer, at Katie Trainer, who says, Merry Christmas, Pod. Merry Christmas, Katie.
Merry Christmas, Katie.
What Christmas movie should be remade with The Rock in the lead role?
Oh, this is a great question.
I mean, you just mentioned It's a Wonderful... No, I'm kidding. Please don't shoot me. Oh, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Okay, I've got one. Muppet's Christmas Carol.
That's exactly what Katie Turner says.
Yeah.
So, you mean as Scrooge, not Kermit?
I mean, either. He'd make a delightful Kermit.
He would.
We know he can sing, sort of, about as much as Kermit can.
I haven't seen Moana yet, so how is he?
He's decent. I don't know that he has an enormous range, but certainly within his range, he's good. Yeah, pleasant tone.
Okay.
Yeah, it has to be songs about him and how great he is, I think. That's his range.
Kermit doesn't sing that much in Muppet Christmas Carol, though, does he? He sings that One More
One
Sleep.
One More Sleep Till Christmas. Was it Sleep? It's not Sleep, is it? That's Leona Lewis, I think.
The season to be jolly and joyous.
It's like when we had Kermit in this very booth.
Yeah. Was there a guy attached to Kermit?
No, I didn't see one.
What do you mean, a guy attached to this? He's just a frog.
It's just rude.
He's just a frog.
We just had Kermit the Frog and Pepe the Prawn, and that was that.
Centipede scenario again.
I once hosted a press conference with the Muppets.
Yes, at one of the
another one.
Oh, a press conference.
Another one. This is when the Muppet movie, The Muppets, came out, and it was brilliant because they had the table, normal press conference table, but it was about 6 feet tall to allow the Muppet. I don't know if you know this, but the Muppets have an entourage and just very close personal friends who are in attendance when Muppets are around, just to make sure they don't fall into any puddles or any harm. And so these friends of the Muppets were just hanging around.
Oh, well, like that makes sense. I mean, obviously the friends and the Muppets were there when we interviewed them, but we made them wait outside. It was just the puppets in the room. Muppets.
And then I did I hosted an impromptu Q&A with Kermit and I want to say Rizzo the Rat afterwards, where we were thrown into a room really, really quickly with a bunch of journalists to do a little impromptu press conference, and there was no table. And so the Muppets' friends came along and sat down with the Muppets and no table, nothing to hide the appearance of the friends. And that was fascinating because you find yourself, I'm sure you found this as well, whenever, who was on the podcast? It was Rizzo, wasn't it? It was Rizzo and Kermit.
No, it was Pepe.
Pepe and Kermit. And I don't know if you've ever interviewed the Muppets face to face.
Not face to face, no.
You do find yourself talking to them.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And not
their friends
who were with them. It's so bizarre. I love it.
Because they do the sort of, they cock their head to one side and they sort of nod when you're speaking.
Yeah.
You know, because they're listening.
Yeah.
So that's why you talk to them. Why would you not be?
Why would you? It'd be rude.
It would be weird not to. Okay, who else? Home Alone.
Home Alone. Home Alone.
Oh, I think you might have nailed it.
The Rock is Kevin McAllister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The Rock is Joe Pesci.
Absolutely. The Rock in every role in that movie.
The Rock in every role.
It would be amazing.
That would be amazing.
I'm going to take Die Hard off the table.
It's too
obvious.
Yeah.
It's too obvious. If The Rock could show up in Love Actually,
Who would he be?
The Rock.
Would he
heavily
be
armed?
No, no. How about The Rock as the British Prime Minister?
That takes the role away from Hugh Grant.
Oh,
he's genuinely one of the best things.
Yeah,
he's
actually not bad.
God awful film. What about the Billy Bob Thornton role?
Oh no, he couldn't be that. No,
no. He's too likable.
Yeah,
I'd be rooting for the president.
Okay, is he the person who could make that? I mean, this
the
is no
really bad bit. Work.
This is no reflection on Andrew Lincoln.
No.
Who is a lovely man and a very fine actor, but that storyline in Love Actually
is
where
terrible.
He is trying to seduce Keira Knightley from under the nose of his best friend, and he's doing it in a really creepy, horrible mm-hmm. fashion. That bit where she goes round. Why do I know this film so well? There's a bit where she goes around. She goes around because the wedding video hasn't come out very well. And she goes around. He's been filming some extra bits. And she goes around to watch the wedding video. And he's just filmed her face for 2 hours because he's a creepy psycho pervert.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then she kisses him when he turns up at a doorstep with that sign business. And it just is horrible.
Yes.
Horrible. And the only way that would work is if he were The Rock. Because then, as great as Chewie is, you'd sack him off, wouldn't you? Because it's The Rock. And you could totally understand that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that makes perfect sense now.
Yeah. The Rock's the only person who could make filming your bride and only your bride for 2 hours seem charming.
He's the charming side of sociopathy.
Well, in semi-seriousness, uh-huh. right, we're probably due a remake of Holiday Inn / White Christmas.
Okay.
And certainly one of those two, apart from the incredibly racist bit, which we'd have to cut out, I think it was Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
They are meant to be ex-army, which would kind of fit The Rock, let's be honest, right?
Yeah.
So he's trying to open an inn in Connecticut, this time with Kevin Hart, because it just probably would be. It's in keeping with his entertain the troops sort of a vibe that he has going on. He did that Rock the Troops event recently.
Yeah.
Weren't they doing it to entertain an old general, or is that in White Christmas? I get the two really mixed up. Anyway, and that could, not entirely kidding, that could work.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I see that. I think he'd make a great Santa Claus. I really do. I think he'd make a great Santa Claus in Fred Claus. He should remake Fred Claus. No. What's that one?
Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, the one about the miracle on 34th Street. What's that one? He'd be pretty good in that.
From just to be clear,
yeah,
Lord Richard Attenborough to Dwayne The Rock Johnson. You see that as a progression.
I mean, I see it as an evolution. I see it as the way that mankind is going.
Well, we'd have to call up David for clarity on that, I guess.
He would absolutely go... I nearly did an impression. But no, I think he would like it.
That would be disrespectful, Chris. You are right not to do that impression. We don't make fun of Sir David Attenborough around these parts.
It's not making fun.
Better not be.
That's Sir David Attenborough with constipation.
No. This is... Okay, that's
Chris.
What?
Oh, God. I've got a good one.
Bring it.
Elf.
Oh.
As
Buddy.
Buddy.
Because the whole joke of Elf is that he's an oversized man in a...
So you think they didn't go far enough?
They didn't go far enough. Will Ferrell is a tall man, but he's not as tall as The Rock, or as wide or as large as The Rock. I'd love to see The Rock in some tiny, undersized little elf jackets, you know, his muscles just sort of bursting out of them.
Okay.
I feel like
we're getting into some uncharted territory here.
Wow.
Sorry, I can't control myself sometimes.
No, I think John may be onto something here.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got one more. Trading Places. And I think The Rock would be fantastic in the Dan Aykroyd role. I can see The Rock as a drunk Santa with a salmon stuck in his beard. That would be a lot of fun. He seems to be on a mission at the moment to remake lots of films with Kevin Hart. Kevin Hart would be a very, very good fit for the Eddie Murphy role. I think that would be a very fun way to go.
Guys, call us. We've got you sorted for the next couple of Christmases.
Trading Places is a fantastic movie. but yeah, it could maybe. It's one of those movies, weirdly enough. It's a bit like Ghostbusters for me. I've said this in the podcast before. It's a beloved movie. I think it's fantastic. I don't know how many jokes there are in it. It's a character comedy. It's a character comedy, and the comedy comes from the character, and there's some amazing, amazing jokes in it, and it's endlessly quotable. But I can see a Rock Kevin Hart version that is more jokey.
All right.
Out and out jokey than Trading Places.
Okay, let's make this happen.
Let's make it happen, Hollywood.
John, give him a call.
I'll just text him.
Yes.
I'll WhatsApp him.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're mates with The Rock.
Yeah. Best buds.
Helen, have you been tweeting about The Rock?
Best buds.
No.
Yeah, me neither.
He did call me his good friend once.
Yeah.
I'm clinging to that.
Yeah, not best buds, though, so.
All right. So we've got two guests on the podcast this week.
Yeah.
Should we have the first one?
Let's do it, yeah.
Okay. So the first one is the writer, star, director, producer.
Overachiever.
Overachiever, T-Man, I think he did the T, he was a gopher, key grip, he did all this sort of stuff on David Brent, Life on the Road, and before that, of course, The Office, and Extras, and Life's Too Short, and Derek, and the Golden Globes, and this, and that, and all over the place. He is one of the giants of British comedy. He is, of course, Ricky Gervais. The film is now available on DVD, Blu-ray, and download. But listen, I'm not going to give him a big intro now, here, right here, because I gave him a big introduction when I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. Listen to the introduction now. Enjoy. Right, press and record. I'll give you a big introduction and away we go. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Ricky Gervais. How are you, sir?
You said it was going to be a really big introduction.
Well,
that was very subdued.
Do you want me to big it up a bit?
No, don't.
No, I can big it up.
No, don't. I can go again. No, you've called my bluff.
No, I'll do it again. No, I'm going to give you a big introduction.
Oh, God.
I'm going to give you a big introduction.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Oh.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by a man who has changed comedy as we know it. A giant of the British comedy. No, the global comedy scene. The man who's created The Office, Extras, Derek, Life's Too Short. The great, the one and only, Richard Gervais.
Oh, just ruined at the end. That was great. I was loving that. That was like a massage.
Shall we go again with the Ricky?
No, that's good. Yes, my name is really. Someone asked me if it was a fake name. And I said, why would I make up the name Ricky Gervais? I'd call myself Hank Bangford or something if I could make. Why would a Ricky Gervais, the first name of a child or Alsatian?
Yeah.
Last name of a 17th century fop. It's like, this is going to be good for my image. No, my real name is Ricky Gervais. I was christened Ricky Dean Gervais. Dean was spelled wrong as well.
You were christened Ricky? I didn't know that.
Yes, no, Ricky. Sorry. Ricky Dean Gervais. D-E-N-E. My mum said my dad was drunk and she let him do one job and he had to fill out the birth certificate. And she went, he was drunk. I don't know if that's true, but I really hope it is. That I got that name because my dad was drunk and was given one job to do with me.
That is amazing. But at least, you know, you didn't get embarrassing initials because some kids can have that. I almost had, you know, I'm C-T-A-H. My mum and dad realized at the last minute that they were going to change. They were going to call me C-A-T-H, and that was Kath. And kids would immediately catch on. They would go Kath and.
Oh, mine is RDG. Mine is the abbreviation for Reading, which is funny. That worked as a kid. RDG.
Do you think that's maybe why your dad did it? Is he so full of local pride, or
No, he didn't. He didn't choose the name. I just think he spelt Dean wrong. I think that was the. I was meant to be Ricky.
It was never meant to be Richard. I don't think so.
Oh, no.
That's interesting. Okay.
It's odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite American. My dad was Canadian, so I think Ricky is quite. I think that's where you might find an adult called Ricky more. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's someone just cutting out the middleman because everyone just ultimately gravitates towards abbreviations of their names. They gravitate towards nicknames. So at some point in your life, you would probably have become Rick or Ricky.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who calls me Rick. Oh, my family, Rick. They call me Rick. Yeah, but no one else does. It sounds weird coming from someone else if someone calls me Rick. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sounds odd. we've covered the name.
I think I grounded you up a bit.
We've covered right. The intro.
Are you
name.
Happy with the intro
that's,
now?
That's all the time we've got.
Have you answered every single question that's conceivable about Life on the Road?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
My thing is, I sort of want to come up with different, more interesting answers every time. But if people ask the same questions, they will get the same answer because it's the truth.
Is there one thing in the film that you've been burning to be asked about, but no one's asked about it?
That'll be no then, won't it? I think my hesitation has answered your question.
Because I imagine everyone's asked about bringing Brent back after so many years away. But I'm fascinated by the impact that Brent has had, not just on pop culture, but on other people as well, and other bosses. I'm a football fan. I'm a Liverpool fan. And I don't know if you're aware about Brendan Rodgers, who was Liverpool's boss.
I see it online. People tweet me with him doing it. People are often compared to...
He had quite a way with him. He was quite articulate. He was quite verbose. And people called him Brenton Rodgers. And that was a nickname that kind of, he was saddled with for a long, long time. That must be something that's...
I guess Brent's become sort of shorthand for... maybe pontificating, I suppose the blind spot, it seems to have captured that the middle-aged man, not being that self-aware, being a bit of a prat and not knowing it. But that is the staple of comedy, particularly sitcom, and probably particularly British sitcom, which is an ordinary person. Usually a middle-aged man, but in general terms, comedy at its essence is an ordinary person trying to do something they're not equipped to do, and that's what's funny, and that's what we laugh at and with, because we're all like that. We all maybe overstep the mark or got wishful thinking or fall flat on our face when we're trying something out of our comfort zone, and that's a good thing. And I think Brent's sort of become quite a pin-up boy for that, and particularly with the sort of the latest chapter of the saga, is that I like that ambiguity. Are we laughing at him, or are we saying well done for trying?
Yeah.
Because I think it was less ambiguous 15 years ago. You know, we were laughing at Brent because he was a bit of a prat. He was showing off. He wanted to be famous. He was a narcissist, and he was sort of not stitched up by the documentary team, but shown to be what he was, right? But now, 15 years later, the world's changed behind his back. So he's all those things, but compared to modern day narcissists and bullies and alpha males, he's all right. Do you know what I mean? In retrospect, he's not that bad, because we've seen that culture change. We've seen people get on The Apprentice since The Office by saying, I will destroy anyone who stands in my way. Fame is now insatiable. Now people live their life like an open wound to be famous. Whereas, you know, The Office came out of me watching some quaint docu-soaps of the 90s where an ordinary guy got his 15 minutes and that was it. But now people will do anything. Now there's an unwritten contract between people getting on telly on Big Brother by saying, I'll behave badly, I promise. And the program makers go, you promise you'll behave really badly and show us your lowest ebb? Yeah, I promise. Yeah. You know, how many times have you seen Celebrity Big Brother, someone going in who's fallen from grace or disgraced themselves, or sometimes through no fault of their own, and they go into Celebrity Big Brother and they say, I want to show the public a different side of me. I'm screaming, going, fuck the public. They want you to fail again. This is entertainment. This isn't therapy.
Yeah.
This is bad for you.
And so,
And so now I think when we see 55-year-old Brent, who's a little bit older and a little bit wiser, the real point is he wasn't that bad. He was only that bad compared to the other people in the office who, but compared to modern day society, he's not that bad. You know, We've just had a president elected who is a game show host, The Apprentice host.
Yeah.
Think of the things he said compared to the things Brent said. Brent's trying to do the right thing. He makes a fool of himself now and again. But it's society is different. And that was the big theme of Life on the Road, I think, that Brent had changed a bit. We all change in 15 years. but the main theme was how the world had changed behind his back.
Yeah.
And that there's a certain irony to the fact that he's trying to do it right. He's not doing anything to be famous, you know. He's writing songs and he's got a band together, but he's not going to be rewarded for that because it's all wrong for him. Mm. He can't do it the credible route because he's a 55-year-old tampon rep. He can't be Bruce Springsteen, however good he is.
Yeah.
It would be better if he entered X Factor and got through on a slightly ironic camp vote. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he might get to what, week five in the finals.
Exactly.
You never know.
Yeah, exactly. But he doesn't want to do it like that. Because he wants, at least he sees that he wants a bit of credibility with his fame. So he's caught between these two worlds. He doesn't want to live his life like an open wound and be rewarded for being awful. He wants to be rewarded for being good. It's just that he's not good enough.
Yeah.
And so I suppose the lesson is that he's looking for something he didn't need. He doesn't need to be famous to have worth. He doesn't need to be a rock star to be liked. He doesn't need to keep proving himself to strangers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
He'd be okay if he just liked himself a bit more.
How many different iterations of the story did you go through when you were putting the film together in terms of what the resolution, in terms of where we leave Brent at the end? Because I think other filmmakers would have had Brent become a huge success in some way at the end of the movie.
Well, that's always dangerous.
That's
isn't
dangerous
it?
That, in itself.
The big, Hollywood ending where,
yeah.
I mean, I've read a script once where a guy trying to make it in a band, right, it ended by him slipping a demo tape in John Peel's pocket at a party, and that was meant to be Happy Ever After. Like that was it. That's it. You know, but you know, 1,000 people try every week to be a rock star.
Yeah.
So it would be odd if David Brent became a rock star.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about that. It was about him thinking that's what he needed because he's been sold this lie that a whole generation has been sold now. If be famous and it'll sort your life out, you'll be happy.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. I mean, it is crazy. We have got a new breed of narcissists. We've got people being born into narcissism and it being rewarded for it. That you can, it's crazy.
Mm.
Why would a little boy or a little girl want to be a doctor when they can get a reality show?
Yeah.
And, you know, we are going to run out of doctors. They're all going to be singers or going on celebrity this and celebrity that.
Yeah.
Next is celebrity enema, I think. People, it's just not out of the question. You couldn't come up with a spoof reality show that in 5 years' time won't be a reality.
This is true. Well, a few years ago was the Farm where people were wanking off pigs.
Sure.
Do you remember that show?
Yeah, I think I do remember that. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's...
Well, to be fair, that does happen. They didn't just invent that. That wasn't...
It is a practice that goes on.
Exactly. That wasn't a game that Jimmy Fallon invented to get... Yeah.
Right, to get your meals for tonight, you have to wank off this pig. Sorry, guys, that's where...
Yeah.
You've signed a contract. You're all in. I will have to let you go, Ricky. But I want to ask one thing. It's about the Liam Neeson appearance on Life's Too Short.
Oh, amazing.
That scene is extraordinary.
Thank you.
And we quote it all the time in the Empire Office, and we retweet it constantly as well.
It's
always brings joy into our lives. Where did it come from?
It came from the fact that during and after extras, I'd be at the Golden Globes and the Emmys and all these big American award shows, and people would come up to me, I mean big stars, and say, can I be in extras, right? And, you know, the first time you think, oh, God, that's flattering. You think, oh, Ryan, try and do something. And, or you go, oh, well, I'll think about it. And then it was all over so quickly. By the time I'd sort of made it in America, extras were sort of over almost.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I think people get the timeline wrong. And so... either at the end of extras or, you know, after it was over, they'd come up to me and some of them would pitch me ideas. And obviously they're awful. Because they were pitching me ideas where they looked good in extras and that sort of, you know. And so, and even on the street, just, ordinary people would come up and go, I've got an idea. And some would be good, some would be bad. But it fills you with dread because whatever it is, even if it was a cabbie telling me a joke, it could be the most horrendous joke in the world, but I'd have to go, oh, you know. And my politeness was, it sort of trapped me in a way. And I thought, imagine that times 10. Imagine not only someone telling you these awful things, but he was 6'5" and one of the greatest actors in the world. And someone who thinks he's funny and isn't. And then we thought, who could that be? Well, the modern day, our John Wayne. It's our generation's John Wayne, isn't it? Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
And he played it just so amazing. Just incredible. There was twice as much stuff.
It was how much improv was it?
Well, it wasn't improv. It was that he then had, then told a joke.
Okay.
That I was going, well, no, don't say that, because that's he's getting it wrong, right? Not seeing the funny side of it, why it was funny. It, honestly, it went on just crying with laughter. And the funny thing was that we also made him a bit of a bully, where that he, I don't do notes. And it would scare me. So that was the idea, when someone's confronted and someone says to you, here's a joke, you can have this. And you think, oh, God. You know, but just make it more and more trapped.
Yeah,
you know, take it to the nth degree. Yeah. So yeah,
because you can't get out. To get to the door, you have to get past Liam Neeson, and well, you just can't do it.
It's great when he says, "I've played Otto Schindler, I've played Rob Roy." You know, I couldn't do a greengrocer, was it? He says, yeah. but it's the way he goes. Well, as I said, I have full blown AIDS. I was excited to have full blown AIDS as a punchline in a sitcom being said by Otto Schindler.
I think I worked it out. I interviewed Liam on the podcast and I asked him about that scene. And I think I've worked it out. All the things he says he wants to do in that speech, you know, crazy characters, improv, all that sort of stuff, he has since done. So it was almost like
They said that about Kate Winslet as well, when she won an Oscar for playing a Holocaust movie. Playing a Holocaust movie, yeah. And I said it to her at the Golden Globes when I got up after she'd won. I said, see, Winslet, I told you. Do a film about the Holocaust and the awards come rolling in. There are lots of things that come true. Then Sam Jackson mistaken for...
Lawrence Fishburne.
Lawrence Fishburne, that's in extras.
Oh my God, you're some sort of weird soothsayer. What's going on?
Yeah, well, the Simpsons have done it by about 300 times, haven't they? Didn't they predict Trump?
They predicted a lot of things, yeah.
No, but it's funny when those little things are imitating life and then the other way around. So, that was fun. Extras was fun. I look back at that as fun, yeah.
And fun, what's fun next for you? You're doing stand-up again?
I've told myself I've got to do this. I just, it keeps getting pushed back, stand-up. And it's sort of, I say it's a third of what I do, but it should be more than a third of what I do, because it is the purest form. It's I don't have to worry about anything. It's just me, you know. There's no collaboration. There's no filter. What I think is what I say is what they hear. Mm-hmm. They might not like it or understand it, but it, you know, there's no and it's a privilege. You know, 10,000 people have come out. They've, you know, got a babysitter and found a parking space, and they've paid a ridiculous amount of money on eBay. And it's just, I want to be really good at it. And it keeps getting pushed back for a sitcom idea or a movie. And it's been 6-7 years. So I'm nearly there. I've nearly got an hour. I'm doing a few more warm ups, and then I'm going to, do a little bit of a world tour.
Fantastic.
By world tour, I mean all the places I have a house.
That's 47 countries, right? something like that.
Yeah. So, that is next. I mean, this goes on, though, because this comes out on Netflix in February and I do it all again. I want to do some more gigs with Brent because that's weird. And that's
you're done.
No,
you're
no,
done.
I do want to do a few more gigs because even though it's sort of outside the narrative a little bit, it's a bit weird that David Brent can sell out venues as fast as the Stones and people sing along. he can't be a loser. But it's almost like there's almost a fourth wall.
Yeah.
You know, they know they're seeing a guy that stepped out of the telly.
Yeah.
They're in on the joke. Brent doesn't hear the cheers. He's still got something to gripe about, you know. Do you know what I mean? But honestly, irony, character or not, when you hear 5,000 people sing along to basically a head on a pillow, that's a huge thrill. So I want to have that again.
Did they hit the notes?
Honestly, it's mad. They sing along to every. It's like a Queen concert. They're singing along to a tampon rep from Slough, and it's amazing atmosphere. Honestly, I've never experienced anything like it. It's ridiculous. More so than my stand up. You know, it's just because he's got a band behind you. It's to music.
Yeah,
it's like. It's amazing. So I want to do some of those just for fun, and I don't want to kill that. I want to keep that for special occasions and do those.
Yeah. Birthdays and
birthdays exactly. Yeah. The Queen's 90th.
Top of Buckingham Palace.
Exactly. Yeah. So that humanity, and then I'm going to do a sitcom third. I'm going to I've got a little bit of a backlog. I never know which one to do. I've got a few ideas. I've got half a dozen things that I don't know what to do, and I won't even start writing that for a year because I want to do humanity and I want it to be the best one I've ever done.
Fantastic.
And I'm doing it differently. With the first four, I sort of wrote them in a way like it was a big Edinburgh show, and this one I've been wandering out and talking to the audience. And I built it much more organically.
Is that terrifying? Because
No, it's not. I'll tell you why it's not. Yeah. Because it doesn't matter what happens. Because I've gone up there and I've said, this is a warm-up show. You know, they're getting for next to nothing.
Do you have notes in your hand, at least?
Yeah, list of things. You know, I think the first time I went out on my hand, it was funny because I looked down and I laughed the first time. It said something like, Golden Globes, Caitlyn Jenner, Vikings. So it just...
Because even this is going already.
Exactly, yeah. That's what I had.
Amazing. Well, I'll let you go off.
Cheers.
It has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much indeed.
Okay, so that's Ricky Gervais, or the bits that we were allowed to broadcast. Very, very funny guy. Very funny guy indeed. Right, so let's have some movie news, shall we?
Sure.
What's been the haps, Daddy? Oh, I've been off this week. I've been away. All I know of what happened in Hollywood this week is that David Ayer is directing another...
Yeah,
DC Comics movie.
Yeah.
Gotham City Sirens, with Margot Robbie returning as Harley Quinn at the head of the cast.
Yeah.
This is, I guess, it's probably good news for anybody who really enjoyed Suicide Squad. So those people are going to be happy.
Yeah.
Probably about this.
I spoke to him and he's delighted.
It made like over $700 million. Yes. So there must be at least one or two of them. Or is it... I don't know.
No. I'm sure there are people who enjoyed it. There are 745 million reasons why David Ayer should make another DC Comics movie. Imagine how many more reasons there would be if Suicide Squad had been any good.
There we go. So Christina Hodson is writing the script. It's based on the Sirens comic book, which also featured Catwoman, Poison Ivy, people like that. And I think they're the sort of the main trio. It's Harley, Catwoman and Poison Ivy. Mm-hmm.
It is quite surprising, this news, I have to say.
Do you think? I mean, it was rumoured for a while.
I'm not surprised about the project itself.
Right.
I think that makes sense. And yeah, you know, it's good to see Harley Quinn back because she was one of the best things in Suicide Squad. But
yeah.
David Ayer coming back to the DC universe, I mean, we had him on the spoiler special, and he did not sound like he was ready to jump back into this world.
Unless he's had assurances, you never know. I mean, there at times is a decent movie threatening to burst out of Suicide Squad, and it has all the hallmarks of being messed around with and interfered with. And who knows? Maybe his original vision, his original cut, was absolutely fantastic, and maybe he's had reassurances that they'll leave him alone this time. It's not uncommon, of course, for directors to return to comic book movies. It's happened loads. Chris Nolan, obviously, Sam Raimi. Within the MCU, we've had the likes of James Gunn return, and Peyton Reed, and Jon Favreau. So it's not unusual. But what is unusual, I think, well, let's say that, is a film getting slaughtered critically and then the director coming back. But then again, it's happened to Zack Snyder's on Justice League, although that was a different situation. That was a film that got slaughtered as he was 2 weeks away from shooting that movie. This is different. This feels different to me. I'm not a fan of Suicide Squad. But you never know. You never know. It might be good. He's not writing it, and that could be crucial.
What's interesting as well in that story, it's sort of buried, but a second Suicide Squad movie is still in the works, which is interesting. Presumably not with David Ayer. I mean, that's still early days yet. I think it sounds like Gotham City Sirens is coming first. But, you know, this it seems like they're still ploughing ahead with their sort of expanded universe.
I mean, I guess it did well, so there you go.
It did well. But I wonder if the Joker's going to be in this one.
Yeah, I guess that may depend on the solo Batman movie going ahead or not.
It might be. They wouldn't have the Joker in that movie, would they? I mean, that's just in the Batman movie. That seems a bit too obvious. But, you know.
Everyone, they have him there in their back pocket, though.
But we all want to see Jared Leto again.
Yeah, I guess.
Fingers crossed. Every day is Christmas Eve.
Elsewhere, other news. So Emma Stone was already down to star in Cruella, the live-action Disney film about Cruella de Vil, of course, the villain in 101 Dalmatians. It now has a director in the Broadway shape of Alex Timbers, who until now most been known for his work on Broadway.
Oh, okay. Well,
he was working on the Broadway adaptation of Frozen, has stepped away from that. His biggest screen work, to be honest, has been on Mozart in the Jungle, which is the very good Amazon comedy series with Gael García Bernal. Yeah, I've been really enjoying it, actually. Haven't seen season 3 yet, but I've been busy working. But yeah, it's not bad. So I guess that's a good sign. But it just goes to show how much experience you don't always need to get a major motion picture job directing, I think. He's another one of these guys who's kind of coming straight up to, you know, a sort of what's probably, an $80 to $100 million movie?
Yeah, something like that.
It's a big leap. Anyway, so that's happening. Ben Mendelsohn has been cast as the Sheriff of Nottingham in the film that I think we all asked for, Robin Hood : Origins.
Yeah, I mean, hey, look, nobody's as big a fan. I interviewed Ben Mendelsohn yesterday and he was an absolute delight. I really like that he's suddenly becoming the sort of villain for hire in Hollywood. But I don't know, do we really need another Robin Hood movie? Or let alone three? I think there's three in development.
There's three.
Really?
I think this one's going to kill
three different,
the other two.
Somehow. Yeah, possibly.
I've got a feeling. This is the one with Taron Egerton as Robin Hood. And Jamie Foxx as Little John, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. This is good casting. Ben Mendelsohn's very, very good. Do you know, I saw a film that I don't know if I'd overlooked it in the podcast, I can't remember, but I saw Mississippi Grind recently.
Oh, it's a great film.
Fantastic film. If you haven't seen Mississippi Grind, it's on Amazon Video at the moment. It's on there, so you can download it, you can watch it. Great, great film about gambling and about human frailty and foibles. Fantastic, really, really good central performances from the duo. He's great. Casting in this movie has been good so far. Again, believe it's a first time director or director who is quite inexperienced at this level.
Otto Bathurst, I believe it is.
But what a name!
I know. So he has that going for him.
He has. I mean, can he? That's the name of a bad guy in a in a Robin Hood movie, surely, isn't it?
Bathurst.
But he's worked on Peaky Blinders and things like that, so it's another leap up from TV.
There we go. Who's that handsome man who's just appeared on your television?
That's
screen?
Jamie Dornan, who's Will Scarlet.
Will Scarlet, Jamie Dornan.
Yep.
50 Shades of Scarlet.
50 Shades of Scarlet.
There you go.
That sounds wrong.
Hot rutting and
no rutting.
Sherwood Forest.
Goodness me.
A Sherwood.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Hi.
There's been some awards.
There have, yes.
Isn't that exciting? We all love awards.
I love them.
Love trophies and things. Golden Globes nominations came out this week.
I'll be honest, I only had one look at these lists, but my overwhelming impression, without wishing to sound negative, was that they're total bullshit. I mean, like, I get, you know, they've hit upon some brilliant people, some brilliant films, some brilliant TV shows, but it kind of feels like it's by accident.
Can I just, I know a little bit of what was nominated.
Okay.
By the shadowy cabal of ancient beings that formed the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. And I think I know the one that's really pissed you off.
Which one do you think it is?
Is it Tom Ford as Best Director?
That was not the one that leapt out. I just rolled my eyes at that. But that kind of, that at least sort of figures. Some of the others,
why does
you're
it
like, it just figures because they think he's important. Everybody thinks he's important. And he is important. He's a very important fashion designer. I'm not sure he's a very important director. I get that, but well, I just.
What was the one that really made you just, you know, lose it?
Well, it was a bit. I mean, Mel Gibson for Best Director. I liked Hacksaw Ridge, actually. I like him. I don't think he's one of the five best directors this year. I'm sorry, no. He just isn't.
I'm with you on that.
You know, obviously my issues with La La Land we're going to talk about in a future week, but
in a future week. I think you're relatively, you're not alone. I've seen other people. I haven't seen La La Land yet, mainly because I can't say it. But you don't seem to be alone in this, but
no.
There seems to be an overwhelming kind of everyone loves it for the most part kind of thing. So you might be on a small island.
Oh, no, I get it. And that's fine. I'm on my island with La La Land. I get that. I still expect it to be nominated. Same with Tom Ford to an extent. Like, I expect
him to be
nominated.
I didn't see Tom Ford coming, so to speak. And I didn't. I honestly didn't, I thought that one took me by surprise. Like, the complete. I don't know whether they saw Silence in time, but they completely snubbed Silence.
I think Silence
just missed the boat a little bit.
Yeah, and Silence is so internal. I mean, again, will we be talking about this in a future week? I won't be here next week, and it's out over Christmas.
We will be, but you will not be. Are you embargoed at this point in time?
I think in theory I am, but loads of the reviews are up. So I'm just going to very quickly say and just hope that nobody's listening.
Nobody's listening, it's fine. We've established that over 4.5 years.
I thought it was phenomenally good, actually, but it is extremely internal, dialed back, theological, never mind philosophical. Mm-hmm. And it is not an obvious. It's not one that demands Oscar attention because, quite frankly, it has its eye on loftier stuff.
Yeah.
And so I feel like in a year where...
The Empire Awards.
Yes. I just feel like it might well be overlooked. I was pleased to see Viggo Mortensen, by the way, nominated for Captain Fantastic. I was pleased by basically all of the Best Actress in a Drama nominations. I am, with the best will in the world, baffled that Florence Foster Jenkins seems to be doing well at a lot of awards.
I'm not.
Nomination. I know it's Meryl Streep, but like, dude.
I think Hugh Grant's fantastic in that film.
He is great.
But the film I think has been overlooked and has been overlooked at all the awards, and it's a real shame, is Love and Friendship. Tom Bennett was robbed. Kate Beckinsale was robbed. Yeah. She's fantastic in that film. And I know there's one listener who wrote into us who says that they really didn't like Love and Friendship and they're baffled by our love for it. But it's a fantastic film, very, very witty. I don't agree with the lead character, but you don't have to. But she's absolutely fantastic in that movie, and I think she deserves to be in the conversation at least. But it's one of those situations that I think this isn't always the case. But if a movie comes out too early in the year, it gets lost,
it can do,
and especially with the Golden Globes, who the HFPA have an average age of 247.
That's right.
They don't have the greatest long term memories.
So,
who knows? I think that's the lizards, the lizard people,
the lizard French people.
I also think Arrival's getting overlooked a bit in the best picture categories generally.
So it sort of looks like a 3-horse race at the moment. Between La La Land, Moonlight,
and Manchester by the Sea. Manchester by the Sea, I think I'm embargoed, but I mean, I was dehydrated after that film. That film is so emotionally moving, my God. It would be my choice, I think. But
I think the momentum is with La La Land at the moment.
I mean, great.
And it, you know, fine. There's a couple of interesting bits from the nominations. One is that Deadpool picked up two nominations.
Yeah.
For best musical slash comedy, because the Golden Globes are rare in that they have a musical slash comedy category.
Yeah, which is...
which is strange and often leads to some odd quirks, mm-hmm. but it does... It's nice to see a superhero movie recognised, because it...
They're not usually, yeah.
Never get awards recognition. And also Ryan Reynolds got Best Actor nomination.
The Best Song category is really, really weird, actually. I think it's bizarre. I think to have Sing in there but not Sing Street, I think is a bit outrageous.
Yeah.
Actually. And
I tell you what's really outrageous is Finding Dory is missed out of the Best Animated category.
Well, the only thing I'll say about that is animated... So last year, the most competitive category, hands down, certainly come Oscar time, was cinematography. This year, no question, it's animation. Animation is stunning this year. Your name didn't get in there either.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So,
but Sing, I've seen Sing. It's fine. It's likable.
It's fine,
but it's very broad and it's not remarkable in any way.
It's
and
not on the same level as those other four.
It does not deserve to be there.
Yeah.
You could put Finding Dory there. You could put Your Name there. You could put...
there's about six others, aren't
there? You could even put like something like Ethel and Ernest there, you know. So I feel like that was a bit of a punt.
Okay, I think we've spent more time than the Golden Globes deserve on the Golden Globes. Let's talk very, very quickly about trailers.
Yeah,
there were some big ones that dropped after the podcast went up last week. Four big ones that I can see: Spider-Man Homecoming, War for the Planet of the Apes, Dunkirk, and Fast and Furious 8, which is called The Fate of the Furious in the States.
Yes.
Over here, we're a little bit more prosaic with our ridiculous movies about car-based destruction. So it's now just called The Grand Tour. No!
No.
No, it's not.
How dare you?
It's called Fast and Furious 8.
Okay, so let's take them on board. So Spider-Man Homecoming, I really enjoyed it. My only quibble was the trailer, at least, was very much jumping up and down and shouting, "We've got Iron Man in our movie, guys!" Which I didn't think they needed. I felt like they should maybe trusted Spider-Man a little bit more. Having said that, you know, really liked the look of it.
I liked the US trailer, which accentuated the high school stuff more than I did the international trailer, which accentuated the blowing up stuff.
Fair enough,
Which doesn't really seem to have anything we haven't seen before from a Spider-Man movie, whereas the high school stuff does to an extent. I think Tom Holland still looks fantastic as Peter Parker. It's amazing. He's a guy in his 60s and he is playing this. And it just looks fun. And seeing Downey as Tony Stark always makes me
smile. I'm not complaining that Tony Stark is in it.
Yeah.
I felt like they needed a bit more confidence in Spidey himself.
But it needs more Aunt May, but listen, it's a trailer. And honestly, I missed the fact that the last shot was Iron Man and Spider-Man for a long time. I thought it was the Vulture flying after Spider-Man. Michael Keaton looks fun. They seem to have gone down an interesting route with the Vulture.
Yeah, there was one shot that looked like Kraven the Hunter, but is that just the Vulture's
rough?
It's just rough.
Yeah, he's well rough. And he is wearing a sort of helmety mask type thing, which brings back Green Goblin flashbacks from the first movie.
That'll
but
be fine.
The MCU have obviously shown that you can have characters whose faces don't move and no one seems to really mind.
Indeed.
So it's all good. So I would give that a solid 6 out of 10.
Okay.
Right. 6 out of 10, okay. Or 3 stars, which is
a recommendation.
A recommendation.
Yeah. Next.
Right. War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, I thought this looked really impressive. I mean, obviously the CGI is now just the uncanny valley. Forget about it. It's crazy. The fur is unbelievable. But more than that, I think there's something very atmospheric about this trailer. I mean, we've never really seen an apes movie set in winter, as far as I can remember.
Well, last one was quite rainy, but and I think this one looks more war-y in that the apes actually are not just using tools; they're using
war-y for the planet of the apes.
Yeah,
I think
that's probably right. Yeah.
In fact, the one thing I didn't like about this trailer was Woody Harrelson's line at the end, where he sort of clumsily shoehorns in, "If they win this war, it truly will be the planet of the apes."
Yeah, we get it.
Come on, dude. I hope he looked at the camera when he said that.
Yeah, exactly.
And winks.
Because I rolled whenever Tom Felton said, "Get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape!" In the first,
you don't need it.
You don't need it. You don't need. You know, it's fine. This is in a different kind of universe now. What's interesting about this is that the human lead seems to be the bad guy, and it doesn't seem to be that much from the point of view of the humans.
I think that may also be part of the confidence that they feel with the effects. Now they're confident that just Caesar and not huge numbers of humans around them can lead it.
Because they're clearly talking more as well. They've become more advanced. I believe they even have a podcast.
So not that advanced.
So no, clearly not. So how did what would you rate that out of that's safe stars, 5 stars?
I'd probably go 3 again, actually.
3, yeah. Solid 3.
I think I might push to a 4.
A 4?
Yeah.
A 4. One day we might even review the movies. Then we have Dunkirk.
Yes. Yeah, so somebody said something about this on Twitter yesterday. I think it was Hello Taylor pointed out that Christopher Nolan fans and Harry Styles fans will both be praising this film to the high seas.
That's
before
a big Fan diagram.
That's a huge, like, that is some. Those are some big circles. But here's my question: what if he cuts Harry's role down a bit too much? What if he pulls a Terrence Malick? We could see a war between fandoms that will destroy the galaxy.
This could be a war for the planet of One Direction.
The Directioners.
I think he's in the trailer quite a bit.
He seems to be in the film.
He seems to be in the film. It's
probably totally safe to go outside.
I don't think it's a question of styles over substance.
Oh.
I really enjoyed the Dunkirk hashtag on Twitter yesterday. It was just full of One Direction fans. There was a gif of Harry Styles drowning in the water and
appearing to drown.
That's not necessarily a spoiler, but the caption was, "This is Harry drowning in our tears."
Amazing. It's a decent trailer. It doesn't have much of a story yet. I mean, I don't know how sprawling this is going to be.
Yeah,
it's a huge rescue operation.
It looks like it's going to be sprawling, doesn't it? It looks like it's going to be very much a sort of an ensemble sort of a piece from that trailer.
Maybe a bridge too far rather than...
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, something like
so
that.
So interesting, but looked beautifully made.
Yeah.
Bit of Mark Rylance. Kenneth Branagh.
I mean, Mark Rylance is just doing his BFG at this point, isn't
he? Much
is. We were sitting in the office yesterday. He's just going to be
Wazzlers.
The Lufty Wafflies.
What are you saying? I don't understand.
The Nazi Watsleys.
It looks good. Yeah. I'm excited.
Looks
probably
good. Looks
a 4, I guess.
4?
Yeah.
Well, 4 for Dunkirk.
Maybe. I don't know. Somewhere up there.
Yeah. Good. Bit of Cillian Murphy, bit of Tom Hardy.
Can't really go wrong, can you?
Can't go wrong with that. It's all good. And then the last trailer, and I think this may be the last trailer.
There's nowhere to go after this.
This is it. It's the end for trailers. And this may be the end for cinema. But if it is...
What a way to go.
Precisely. This is the Fast and the Furious of the Fate of the Furious 8. And it's completely bonkers.
Totally bonkers.
The trailer is about 3 minutes long. I hope that the film is 4 hours long because this has so much plot.
So much. So we've got Vin Diesel going bad and turning his back on family.
Family.
Because of Charlize Theron.
No!
So presumably it's like mind control or like she's holding somebody hostage or like it's going to be something, isn't it? Anyway, and so they have to get The Rock out of prison.
The Rock's in prison for some reason.
Because he would be. Like, he's broken the law like a lot. And he's, you know, a lawman, so he really should be paying accountable.
He should be.
So he's broken out of prison with Jason Statham to bring down Vin Diesel. Basically,
Helen,
I was nearly
simple.
As confused by this as I was by Transformers last week.
It's fairly simple.
Okay.
Dom Toretto and his family have they're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's a big epic heist, and they're teaming up with Luke Hobbs on this heist for reasons, and then. As they're getting away from this, Luke Hobbs, Dom Toretto, decides to turn on his family.
No!
And presumably in the aftermath, Luke Hobbs gets captured. And the police go, "Hey, what are you doing, man? Go to prison. And not just any prison. The same prison as Deckard Shaw." And then we have Mr. Nobody, played by Kurt Russell, who has Scott Eastwood. Do you know how short Scott Eastwood is?
Is he?
That's one thing that's the real takeaway for me from Suicide Squad and this. He seems to be quite short, like 4 feet, something like that. He's like 5'9", 5'10", something like that. That's what it seems to be.
I mean, it says he's 1.8 metres, which would be what?
1.8 metres, what is that?
Like 5'10"?
5'10"?
5'11"?
5'10"?
I don't know.
He has a weakness. Just saying. Anyway, so he is with Mr. Nobody, and then they break out, they decide to get Jason Statham, who's trying to kill the guys in the last movie, now to team up with the guys to go after Dom, and then Charlize Theron. I hope she gets more to do than this, than just scowl in the background, and just kind of go, ooh. I hope she does more.
I mean, she's really good at that, don't get me wrong.
She's great.
Okay.
But we haven't seen Helen Mirren. There's tons of stuff we haven't seen. A plot, character development, anything like that. But it does look like enormous.
I mean,
fun.
This is a 5-star trailer, isn't
Come
it?
On.
It's a six-star trailer.
It's an eight-star
trailer. Amazing, amazing stuff. Right, let's move on now to our second guest this week. He is one of the stars of this week's big film, perhaps even this year's big film, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. But he's an acting legend. Across films like Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, The Last King of Scotland, for which he won an Oscar, of course, The Crying Game, tons and tons of movies. He is the great Forrest Whitaker. He was speaking to the just as great Ian Freer. I know. Listen to this. Enjoy it. That's an order.
Forrest Whitaker, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm good. It's good to be here.
Cool. Rogue One is kind of out in the world now. Yeah. Has it kind of been difficult to keep it secret?
It's funny, I mean, you just kind of accept that everything is a secret from the very beginning, from when you get the script sent to you, how it's, like, delivered to you, and how, you know, you can't copy it or you can't even print it, you know what I mean? To, like, when you get the character and you're in the film, not being able to even... In my case, they didn't want to tell anybody who I was even playing.
Yeah, that's what I remember,
a long
yeah.
long time.
Yeah.
That went on for... God, it feels like a half a year, a long time. And then finally they announced that, or that came out, and then when they decided they wanted to show that.
But I guess the secrecy is that he was a character who's existed in Star Wars before, isn't he? I think George Lucas created him for Star Wars Underworld, a TV series.
Yeah.
Then he turned up in Clone Wars, and now he's in Rogue One. Did you know the history of the character? Did you look at that?
I talked to Gareth. When Gareth first brought me, you know, talked to me about doing the part, he started to show me some images and things that he was thinking about, and he talked to me about Saw. And I started to do a bunch of research when he decided for me to play the part. And, right. and the research was looking at the Clone Wars.
And what did you think of that?
I really love the Clone Wars. I think they're great.
Yeah, they're really good.
You know? Yeah, they're really good. They're well done, too.
Yeah.
But my character was really interesting in there. And so I started to build and shape a little bit about his philosophies and the things that had happened to him in his life. I had already been given a past history, which is cool as an actor. Yeah.
So how would you kind of describe his relationship to the Rebel Alliance and the Rebellion?
Well, I mean, he started with them working. I mean, he started it with the Rebel Alliance, and he was always someone who had very strong opinions. You know? ultimately, he felt that the threat was so great, the destruction really of the universe and the control and the freedom of mankind or humankind, not even humankind, universe, I don't know what you call it, universal kind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But that he needed to do what was ever necessary.
Yeah.
And that, like, pushed him into another area where he started to do things that were more extreme.
Yeah.
And ultimately the Alliance disconnected themselves from him, and he was his own, in a way, rogue rebel force. And just him and his fighters, saw his fighters.
So he's kind of the darker end of the Rebel Alliance, as it were.
He is. I mean, he became that. I mean, he was always sort of, struggling with I guess, the light and dark. But he's, at some point, he realized that what was going to happen was so great that he was willing to make the compromises, moral compromises, ethical compromises, whatever it would take to do, which the others weren't willing to do. But he said, well, he was necessary. And in these kinds of conflicts and stuff, quite often you'll find that when you have a peaceful force, there's an alternative violent force that is doing other extreme things. And the question is, without that balance or without those continual progs, you know, would you be able to solve the conflict at all?
That's fascinating stuff for a blockbuster movie, isn't it? That's a great area to be in.
Yeah, it is, you know, because I remember when I was sat there watching, and the first image comes out, I was like, whoa! You know, it, like, overtook you, you know what I mean? It's like, it's so visual, it's got all the things that I think that people are used to, or even more in some of the war saga, you know, but it does go into an area that I think is really interesting, which is what we just talked about. And,
yeah.
And also it goes into that area of like finding your belief, something to stand for, something to live for. I think Felicity's character ends up doing that. And we meet her, she's so, in some ways it feels a little lost.
Right.
And, you know, Mads is her dad and he's doing different things. But ultimately she starts to see what's happening to the people. And she makes a decision.
Okay. How did you think about the kind of physicality of the character and... because he's gone battle hardened, isn't he? Would you say that?
Yeah. We see his battles all over his body, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously he's like, something has happened to his lungs and everything. He's like, his breathing apparatus, you know, you see, you know, his leg, he's got a robotic leg, you know, from another battle. So, you know, all those scars like weigh out on him. And when we meet him, he's trying to, what he thinks, fight off the final battle.
Yeah.
You know, and,
is that fun stuff to play all that? That kind of.
Yeah, I had a great time actually. I loved the character. It's quite like not any I've played before. You know, he's had to take the leadership in such a strong way that you do feel sort of like a kingdom, if it's a kingdom, and like it's this rebel force of his, rebels, and. And it's kind of like exciting to play all those things, the philosopher, the warrior, king.
Yeah. I was thinking about your character in Ghost Dog, kind of which is kind of has a Bushido element in Star Wars, isn't there? Did you find that kind of a through line sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Bushido, philosophy, the Book of Five Rings, in the case of the Hakuri, in the case of Ghost Dog, but I think that always attracted me even as a kid when I first saw my first Star Wars, was looking at battles, and they had that feeling of like certain types of philosophical thought that I had been studying and training in and stuff at the time. And so we feel that here, and you see that with like you talk about his injury, but it looks like a walking stick, but actually it's a fighting implement. He was trained by Anakin Skywalker, he was trained by Obi-Wan, he's been trained in that area, and those philosophical thoughts about as we were just discussing.
Cool. Okay. You seem to be owning science fiction in 2016. So because you were in Arrival, which you've just seen. Tell me about that. How that turned out fantastically, didn't it? You must be delighted.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it's interesting, a thing about communication and connection. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, to be a science fiction film, I thought it had like a really powerful, important social message about the world, and about how we need to connect and be able to communicate and not to make false judgments and judge too early, to try to understand first. And I enjoyed getting to be a part of it, in that sense.
Yeah. So I think military men in those kind of movies, they're often kind of hard types and stern types. And I thought you brought other kind of colors to that character, I thought.
I was trying to, understand him like from the inside out.
Yeah.
So I created somebody that I, very specifically from sort of a Boston area who like had been through certain conflicts and had a certain makeup. Because I've met some of these warrior generals and stuff, like the Colin Powells and the different people of the world.
Wow.
There's an ease about them, and there's an innate intelligence. Actually a twinkle in their eyes too sometimes, that maybe I didn't get the twinkle as much as I should have. but they have something that's quite unusual, and I was trying to infuse a little bit of that into this character.
Okay, I looked at the beginning of your career, and most actors kind of just play a guy in a thing when they start, but you kind of work with Cameron Crowe, with Scorsese, with Oliver Stone, all these kind of great names. That's an amazing way to start a career, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been really fortunate. I mean, I think I was always just looking for opportunity to continue to grow as an artist, and I would most of the time just try to do things that I really believed in, like allowed me to do that. And then sometimes the opportunities are just great, like doing Bird with Clint Eastwood. That's just a great opportunity to get a chance to do something like that. Or Scorsese, I'd always, he's a brilliant filmmaker. And to just get this one scene, but it'd be a very special scene in The Color of Money, was really good, to be across from.
So if people haven't seen it, you play a hustler, don't you?
Yeah.
It's just it's a brilliant little scene. It's amazing.
Yeah, I hustled Paul Newman. And that kind of sparked me for, I think, to get a lot of other things. And then I've been able to work with some really exceptional guys. Like you say, Oliver is an exceptional filmmaker. You know, lots of them. You know, I think Neil Jordan, Crying Game. There's so many filmmakers that I've gotten the chance to work with, and new ones now that I think are really talented.
Mm. And then does winning at Cannes one thing, but winning an Oscar, does that mean a completely different kind of shift in interest in you and career in you?
I mean, I think that I can't say that the roles are better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I had played some really extraordinary characters before. Yeah. I got to do Ghost Dog, as you say. I'd done, you know, Bird. I'd been in The Crying Game. I'd done a number of different films. Maybe at times it made my value that they were calibrating maybe more to make a film.
But I guess at the end of the day, for your point of view, it doesn't make your performance any better or any worse, does it?
I don't know if the characters were that much. I mean, I played... what did I play? I mean, I've played like in The Butler, you know, like I loved playing that character and I'm very proud of it, you know. So that would be one of those films afterwards that does that, but otherwise I had already been doing a lot of really, like I'd done Smoke with Wayne Wang, you know?
Yeah
I'd done a lot of really interesting films with like extraordinary filmmakers, you know. I'd done Olivier Dahan, you know, who had done La Vie en Rose. Got a chance to work with him, you know. I mean, Robert Altman,
yeah,
I worked with him, and you know, Prêt-à-Porter. So I don't know if that same thing, I don't know if it changed much. I'm still doing the same, I'm still searching the same kind of roles to play in the same kind of films. This one's different. This is all about personal growth.
Yeah. And the final question, talking of interesting filmmakers, you've been working with Ryan Coogler and you're going to be in Black Panther.
Yeah.
What can we say about that?
I'm excited to do it. I mean, I think Ryan's an amazing filmmaker.
Yeah, brilliant filmmaker.
You know, I've got a chance to know him since college, you know, and so I'm excited to see what it's like to be working with him on the other side, not as a producer, but as an actor, you know, because that's how we started with Fruitvale Station.
And can we say anything about your character?
Yeah, he's like the shaman, you know, of this community. He's like to the prince, and so.
Forrest, that's great stuff. Thank you so much. A pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so that was Forrest Whitaker and Ian Freer talking about Rogue One, and now let's talk about Rogue One. There is another movie out this week. There are other movies out.
Other movies are available.
Yes. Let's talk about Rogue One, though. And we will, of course, be having a spoiler special for this. Big noise, big noise of a movie. So that's going to be out on Monday, December 19th, with Gareth Edwards, the director of the movie, talking about the film, and four of us Egypts talking about it as well. So, but first, Helen.
Hi.
As non-spoiler as you can.
As non-spoiler as I can. Okay, so we open on a sort of foreign planet. Looks a little bit like Iceland, weirdly. And there, Galen Erso, or aka Mads Mikkelsen, is living in peace and quiet with his family, with his young daughter, Jin, who will grow up to be Felicity Jones, for example. But his idyll is interrupted because director Krennic, played by Ben Mendelsohn, turns up and presses him into service.
Not Otto Bathurst. He's
presses him into service to work on the Empire's weapons program. So he is forced to leave his daughter behind. She has to basically hide under a rock until she's picked up by her guardian. And she has to then fend for herself while her dad is basically forced to build a giant round weapon for the Empire. Let's call it, I don't know,
Star of Death.
And basically that's the sort of first kind of 5 minutes. So we cut then to about 15-20 years later. She is kind of struggling by on her own. She's in prison, she's broken out by the rebellion, and it transpires that a message from her dad has gotten out, and everybody is basically trying to find out what this was, what has happened, and whether there's any kind of hope, because there are rumours already about a new weapon which is causing problems in the galaxy.
What this needs is a new hope to combat.
Yeah, but it's not going to get one in this film, is it?
No, you know? It's not. So this is a prequel. This is a prequel, obviously, to the first Star Wars movie.
Yes, in our chronology, yeah, as opposed to in internal chronology. So yes, this takes place essentially immediately preceding A New Hope.
It's the first standalone Star Wars movie.
Yes.
I have not seen it as of yet.
Okay.
I'm going to go see it today. So what are we in for?
I was really, really positive about it. I really liked it. I think it starts off, there's a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing at the start because you've got a lot of characters, obviously, to introduce. You know, you don't come with that built-in knowledge of who C-3PO and R2-D2 and those kind of people are. So you have to kind of establish all of that. So we have Cassian Andor, who's Diego Luna's character. He's the sort of... he's interesting. He is the cocky kind of rebel fighter, but he's a little bit morally murkier than you might expect of him, which I kind of liked. I think it's interesting that he's not a straightforward good guy here. There's a little bit of a real edge of ruthlessness to him, I think. He works with K2SO, who's the droid voiced by Alan Tudyk, who is by some distance the sassiest droid in the Star Wars universe, at least on screen so far. I think there's a Knights of the Old Republic droid who was kind of a homicidal maniac. He's a little bit like that, but he's much funnier on purpose, I think, than the regulars. Forrest Whitaker is a rebel two hardliner for the rebellion, which is pretty cool. Riz Ahmed is a pilot. And I'm not going to say too much about him for fear of spoilers. Is that everybody? Is that the main ones? Oh, and Donnie Yen. Who's amazing as the force-sensitive guardian of the Jedi Temple at Jeddah.
And Jiang Wen as Baze Malbus.
Yes.
Who's sort of Donnie Yen's like partner in crime. He's always carrying a massive weapon.
He's his probably hetero life partner,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly,
or
yeah,
possibly not hetero, I don't know. You can read it however you want.
Exactly.
But definitely partnership there, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. It's a funny one, this one, isn't it? Because it's a very unusual Star Wars movie. I mean, there's no opening crawl.
Yep.
There's no John Williams score.
There's some very John Williams-y cues.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Michael Giacchino, who did compose it, is very much taking his literal cue from Williams.
For the first few people that I've spoken to, that was maybe not, you know, you do miss John Williams.
Yeah.
And there are the occasional theme pops in when it's required.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, it's very much a Star Wars movie. There's a lot of touch points that I feel sort of, I mean, in our review, I think we said it's like the ultimate Star Wars fan film because it really, it pays a lot of tributes to the series mythology. There's some moments.
Yeah, even some tiny characters turn up. Yeah.
There's some very interesting cameos from people you might not expect to see. Some in real form and some in CGI form.
Yeah, there are some CG humans here.
Yeah.
Now, this is the holy grail of visual effects, really. This is the one thing that nobody's really confident they can 100% pull off. But these are, I would say, the closest human characters to the edge of the uncanny valley that we've seen in a while. They're on a sort of an outcropping near the edge of the valley. They're trying to leap over onto the out of the valley, but they haven't quite got there yet. But they're in scenes with real humans, and that's quite impressive. One thing I would say, by the way, is I agree. It there's a lot of it that feels like a real Star Wars or a real Star Wars, a traditional Star Wars movie. But there are some things that are different. And I think one of them is that Gareth Edwards, the director, was not kidding when he said that this is harder edged and tougher. If you have sort of 6-year-old kids who loved The Force Awakens last year, who are maybe really excited for this one, maybe go see it yourself first and form a view on whether or not it's going to be a bit much for them.
Yeah, it goes to some dark places, doesn't it?
It does.
Places that you don't expect. And it's amazing actually how emotional it is. I think
very much
I was moved by this maybe more than any other Star Wars movie. And that surprised me a lot. And also just that last third act.
Yeah, the third act is, I thought, astonishing.
On the whole, it's just really impressive.
This is interesting. This is the third act that was apparently significantly retooled.
I heard that most of what they added was humour, and there are moments of humour throughout the film that kind of keep you going. But I think for whatever reason now, certainly the action in the third act is genuinely fascinating. It is definitely a war movie at that point, and it is shot in just a really interesting way. It just looks different to any Star Wars film we've seen before, while also having certain traditional Star Wars elements to that third act. So I just really loved it. I thought it was great. I think I actually, in the end, wasn't as fascinated by Krennic as I hoped to be. I thought, just because of, not necessarily because of Ben Mendelsohn, I thought he's great, but I think his role is not quite what you expect it to be, and he doesn't make the impact of other Star Wars villains. But there are other villains around, so that you don't feel that absence too much. But he's not quite maybe as iconic as I would have liked.
His cape's pretty iconic, though, isn't it?
His cape is pretty ace, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just the way it swooshes around. Oh.
What a cape.
I'm very intrigued. You have sold me. I will be going to see this little-known independent movie at my earliest convenience. 4 stars in for Rogue One, a Star Wars story. The next Star Wars film, of course, is Episode VIII.
Indeed, yes, next year.
Very exciting. Cool. So there is another film out this week, and it does have a Star Wars connection, doesn't it, John?
It does indeed, yes. This is The Eagle Huntress, which is a documentary which features, if you wanted to see a non-Star Wars film, but you still need your Star Wars fix, it has a narration from Daisy Ridley, a.k.a. Rey from The Force Awakens, of course. She only narrates for about 5 minutes. She came on board with the film once it had finished, and she loved it so much she just wanted to be involved. So she adds a bit of what she calls hand-holding just to help the audiences through. So it's a really fascinating story about this 13-year-old girl who wants to become an eagle hunter. This is a 13-year-old Kazakh girl from Mongolia named Aishapan, in a sort of nomadic culture where eagle hunting is a big part of the culture in gathering food. And there are many village elders in this community who really would rather not a young girl take up eagle hunting. There's some amazing quotes from some of the elders just saying, "Oh, women are fragile, they're weaker, they can't handle the winter," you know. And so she quite spectacularly proves them wrong. We see her capture an eaglet from a nest and then train it and then take it to this sort of national eagle hunting competition where she wins in record times, which is quite amazing. It's shot in a beautiful sort of David Attenborough style swooping scenery. It's just the most incredible Mongolian countryside. And it has a really sort of strong and interesting message for you know, young girls. It's something quite empowering about it all. I mean, it's you know, it's sometimes quite prescriptive. The editing sometimes sort of seems a little bit engineered, but on the whole, it's a really beautiful piece of work. And it's got something that I think can speak to everyone.
Cool.
And yeah, it's just epic. So if you need a bit of sort of counter programming, let's say, from Star Wars, then this is
go and see the Daisy Ridley movie.
Yeah,
you spoke to her about this, didn't you? So,
I did. I interviewed her for the website. Okay. Please go and have a read of that, because she's very passionate about this film, and you know, she just wanted to bring her profile to draw a bit of attention to it. And yeah,
okie dokie. 3 stars for The Eagle Huntress, and that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Michael Fassbender, star and producer of Fassassin's Creedbender. He's here. He's in the studio. He's not in the studio. I went in the hotel room.
Sorry. You were in a hotel room with him.
I was in a hotel room with Michael Fassbender.
Golly.
Shame.
Oh, Chris.
What? Anyway, also we have a couple of specials coming up as well. We have the Rogue One Star Wars Story spoiler special. That's going to be out on Monday, December 19th. And then we have the Review of the Year podcast, a close to 2-hour jamboree of nonsense. Oh, yeah. And that's going to be out just after Christmas.
Yes.
27th, 28th,
something
like
that. Yeah.
Something like that. So keep an eye peeled for that one. Say goodbye to Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo, yeah.
Say goodbye to the regular podcast for the last time this year.
Oh.
And say goodbye to John Nugent.
Goodbye.
That's how this works. And it's goodbye from me as well. I am off to tackle Otto Bathurst and halt his nefarious schemes.
Bathurst!
Oh, you!
He could be a delight.
He's
you
a
don't
lovely,
know.
Lovely guy. See you next week. Thanks. Bye. Bye.